Colonel Jackson, reel number 5. Colonel, on the question of communications within the tank itself, what superseded this idea of the reins from the commander?
Well, as the design of turret turntables improved, and the design of the wireless set from the old MBMC, there was a control box fitted which you could switch to IC, internal control, and speak direct to the driver, which was a great improvement. And also to other members of the crew if you had more than a two-man tank. It took a lot of getting used to, and you used to hear screams of driver right or halt coming out over the main net, but it was a tremendous improvement.
When did this come about, Colonel?
It gradually came in from, I suppose, about 1933 onwards, and gradually took over completely. And then later on, of course, more improvements with the 19 set, when we had what was so very much required, which was a B set for troop control with a limited range.
How limited was this, Colonel?
It was very limited, to a matter of hundreds of yards. But you had freaks where you could get a B set to transmit over a matter of miles, but it was very rare. It didn't interfere with anybody else. It was entirely for control within the regiment of troops or sections.
When would you say they'd perfected the means of communication within the tank?
Well, I suppose it's never perfected, but I think with the Centurion we had as good as you can get. And of course it improves all the time now. One of the big problems was when you used a regimental net, as in the tank brigade we were pretty well all on a regimental net, all the battalions. You've got to have a rear link for communication with brigade or with your B echelon. That was a big problem, to pass a message from one frequency to another. And it had to be done either verbally or by passing a written message. But with modern improvements, you can have a rebroadcast and speak on what amounts to two frequencies. But we didn't have any of those luxuries.
What about maintenance of the wireless sets those days?
Yes, the maintenance was done by our fitters and very often by the crews themselves, such small things as changing a valve or mending a broken connection or something of that nature. Simple ones were done by the crew. The main ones, problems were done by the fitters, who, as far as I can remember, had advice from the brigade section of the Royal Signals. There was a brigade signals officer who supervised the maintenance and the battery problems of all the battalions in the brigade.
Was wireless communication better, for example, in the Middle East when you were in Egypt? Was there any difference in...
No, I don't think there's any difference at all. I think in some of the all the time with the tank brigade. It just had to work, and it did. It was a matter of Brigadier Hubbard insisted on officer to officer wireless communication, and it made the officers take much more interest in the maintenance of their sets and in the control and operation of them. And it did work, and it worked very well. And in fact, with the tank brigade, we used to get visits from officers from armored car companies or extra regimentally employed to be taught how to operate and how to control a company or a section by wireless. It was very good indeed, the wireless control, with the sets that we had.
What about voice procedure?
Yes, voice procedure was the common one, the Royal Signals voice procedure, the general one in the army, and it was learned very quickly. It was very simple. I can't remember the exact procedure because there have been so many changes since. And it rather muddles you up for what was happening then. But of course we were still on the Ak Bir Korp Don naming of letters.
Was there any suggestion at any time that the Royal Signal should take a greater part in the Armoured Corps on this aspect?
I don't think there was, no. We were only too pleased to have their advice, but not to have a signals operator in each tank. That wouldn't have fitted in with either ours or the Royal Signals ideas. Training our own operators was by far the best solution. And eventually, of course, trade recognition and trade pay was obtained for them.
Turning to general maintenance of a tank, what were the major difficulties in this direction, mechanical?
Well, with the medium tanks, track trouble and bogey trouble was one of the big problems. And to ease this, from over some considerable time, bogey changing competitions were introduced at things like the Royal Tank Corps sports and regimental sports. And the changing of a bogey time was reduced tremendously this way. Of course, you had the inevitable specially prepared vehicles, but it didn't make any difference to the sequence of the drill for changing a bogey. And people got extremely good at it. And then there was a certain amount of trouble with steering brake linings. They went pretty frequently, had to be changed, both on the mediums and on the light tanks. Track pin trouble with the light tanks, and road wheel trouble. The road wheels, the rubber tire on the road wheels was always giving trouble. We used to carry spare track plates on the light tanks for quick replacement, and a spare road wheel if we could fit it up. The fitters used to fit a device for putting a spare road wheel on the front. Engine trouble was not all that frequent. Synchronization of carburetors and magnetos on the mediums did give a certain amount of problems, but not trouble. On the light tank engines, the Meadows and the Rolls-Royce were very trouble-free. But if there was a big job to be done, the driver used to assist the fitters. If it was beyond the fitters' powers, the driver usually went in with the vehicle to the ordnance workshops.
An important man, I believe, for maintenance was the driver mechanic, wasn't he?
Yes, the driver mechanic was a wonderful breed of man. He was usually a lance corporal and didn't want promotion, because if he went beyond the rank of lance corporal, he lost his driver mechanic's pay, and the pay of a corporal or sergeant was far less than he would get as a tradesman. And so we had a number of driver mechanics in each battalion who were very senior and very experienced and devoted to their vehicles and their job, and they were the backbone of the battalion as far as keeping vehicles on the road went. Their loss was a very sad one, but of course it was really better to, when the trade structure was altered, it was really better that they should have the more senior ranks and be able to train the junior ones. But they were a tremendous blessing at the time.
When did this restructuring take place?
As far as I can remember, round about 1939, 38 and 39, the new trades details were worked out and finally came into being.
When did the REMI start playing a part in this aspect?
REMI didn't come in until well after the war had started. I should say about 1941 or 42, when they took over the Royal Army Ordnance Corps workshops. And of course with that, the REMI took over the light aid detachments with each tank battalion.
Was there not earlier talk of them coming in to the Corps before that?
I can't remember, any, because we had the ordnance fitters before that, and they merely took over, they changed their name from Ordnance to REMI. So there was really no structural change, it was just a change in name.
You mentioned, Colonel, the difficulties of maintenance and how they were overcome from the engine point of view. What about the shortcomings of the tank in action?
Well, of course, the medium tank never went into action. It would have been a death trap if it had been, because of the size of the armour. It was a very thin coating of armour. The light tank did go into action in the first part of the the war, both in Europe and in the Middle East. But it was perhaps a very unhappy part of the experience of the Royal Armoured Corps. It was not really up to active service. And it was not until the introduction of the A9 and the A10 cruiser type vehicles, and the A13 and the Matilda. And the Matilda 1 was a smaller vehicle with only a machine gun. Matilda 2 was the one perhaps best known as Matilda, which had a 2-pounder and was very heavily armoured and did some extraordinarily good work in France and in the Middle East.
In the interwar years, did the tanks encounter any difficulties in going over obstacles because of their lack of strong armour?
That's very hard to say. I think probably because of their lack of heavy armour, they were able to negotiate some obstacles better because of their weight. But I remember an occasion when Colonel Hubbard wanted to try out a medium tank going through a wood. And he selected a tank of my section, and one of my drivers, Lance Corporal Hewitt. And so the wood had trees of varying size, from saplings to 8 or 9 inches across. And he made this, he gave a route for this tank, and the driver was told to go flat out at it, which he did. And it was extraordinary what a medium tank could do in the way of knocking down trees. But in the process, it was so successful, it buckled the armour on the tank, and it was, the bodywork was a complete write-off. It was just completely buckled. There was a problem of the Court of Inquiry, but that was got over by various means. But it was a very useful demonstration.
A fairly expensive one, possibly.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Colonel, at this time, the middle 30s, the Army was training, in effect, for two roles to play, one the imperial defence and the other one the possibility of sending an expeditionary force to France. In your view, from where you were, did you see the army ideally situated for either of these roles?
Well, it was too small. It really had its work cut out to fulfil its requirements in imperial defence. But the tank brigade, I think, was really a step towards the expeditionary force type of requirement for the army. It's hard to say which people preferred. I think, on the whole, they would they liked the idea of independent armoured car companies and imperial defence far better than the more concentrated training of the tank brigade and the tank battalion supporting infantry divisions, which meant really a lot of hard work in manoeuvres during the summer, and a lot of training with the other arms during the winter. Whereas in Imperial Defence, you had your own show and could do a tremendous lot and experience active service conditions, if not active service, with your own command, which was very much liked by the people of the day.
Colonel, in 1937 you came back to Bovington, having left Egypt. What was your job then?
My job then was training recruits. Recruits were coming in very fast with the threat of war in the future, and also it wasn't very long before national service was instituted, and then there was a constant flow for training, and the Royal Tank Corps Depot and the Royal Tank Corps Centre was extremely busy and increased in size.
What sort of quality recruit were we getting at that time?
It was quite a good quality. Some of them, of course, were people who couldn't find a job elsewhere. But on the whole, I think they were very good quality. And those who joined because of the imminence of war were keen and willing to learn and very soon shaped up into good soldiers. But it took some time to, I think it's quite a general opinion that it took really about 2 years to make a Royal Armoured Corps soldier, with the depot training and the specialist training and then experience in a unit. And after that 2 years, they began to really be useful and excellent soldiers.
Was there any special qualification for them to come in to the Corps at that stage?
I don't think there was at that stage. I think they were being allotted to units as they appeared to the infantry, and ourselves and the cavalry were getting our fair share. There was very little selection, I think. Before that, we were getting the cream. The Royal Tank Corps was getting the cream of the recruits enlisted.
Before what?
Before the big influx,
yes,
of around about 1937-38.
So when the large numbers started to come in, your quality in some ways went down, did it?
No, I think the end product was produced was as good as the pre-influx type. A lot of hard work had to be put into it, but they were very willing and they learned quickly and they were keen. On the whole, that is, we had our bad ones.
Now, you must have seen some changes in those, 6 or 7 years you've been away. Was there much change in Bovington's?
There was a lot of change, yes. The Signal School was instituted. The D&M School was enlarged. And as far as I remember, took on some of the recruit training, whereas previously recruit training had been entirely the job of the depot. The gunnery school, it didn't affect that all that much at the time. And of course the depot was changed rather a lot. I can't really remember all the differences, but there certainly was a big stir going on. And then, of course, as war came nearer, the 55th, I think it was, training regiment for young soldiers was started at Bovington, and a special barracks was built for them down in the area where the junior leaders regiment now is. So.
Was that an infantry then? Was that infantry?
No, Royal Armoured Corps. Mm-hmm.
And then in 38-39, just before the war and just at the beginning, you became adjutant at Lulworth.
Yes.
What sort of new developments were taking place in gunnery at the time?
There was a tremendous lot of work going on with powered turrets. That is, with traversing by either electrical or mechanical means. And also, there was some thought of stabilization, but there was no tank then which was stabilized either for traverse or elevation. And also there was a lot of thought given to anti-aircraft tanks. The firm Bolton and Paul, who were very much interested in this and produced turrets for a light tank, which were tried out at Lulworth, we had always taught at Lulworth firing from the move, firing on the move, I should say. That was still continued, but with the increase in recruits, a lot more firing had to be done from static positions and from simulated vehicles on the 30-yards range and in such places to get through the large number of people who were coming. And of course, the cavalry, being mechanized, they were coming down to Lulworth to fire their practices. And some of them, of course, were firing from tanks for the first time, so it took quite a lot of instructor time to do that.
What were the difficulties in getting power, Travis?
I don't know what the difficulties were, but it required an enormous amount of experiment to get them right, either by hydraulic means or electrical means. And, there were various types tried out. I can't quite remember all of them. The experimental wing at Lulworth was gradually enlarging and doing a wonderful job of work too.